From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 800-462-7413. And along with your calls, we have some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Yes, we're going to talk about emergency rooms when you go there and you actually are told, hey, we need to do a scan, whether or not you should actually do it or not do it, and what are your rights? Very interesting topic
that we're going to talk about. Sounds interesting to me.
And the FDA, better vaccine against shingles virus, really important. Shingles is a miserable disease. Too many people still get it. This is a new immunization that may help you.
And a yummy recipe?
Yeah, zucchini noodles with avocado, pesto, and shrimp. I love zucchini, except when it's in season when I get sick of zucchini. I love avocado, I love pesto, and I love shrimp. What is there not to love about this recipe?
Moving right along. Let's get to the phones. 800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our first caller, joins us from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, about 3 months ago, my wife, who's active duty military, came home and she had a myriad of symptoms, fever, headache, nausea. She had some swelling in one of her ankles. And we didn't know what was going on. We went into the military clinic, and as we're in the ER, I start doing some research on my phone, and I said, this looks like 7 of the 8 symptoms of Rocky Mountain spotted fever from a dog tick that is carried by deer, usually, they say. You know, it was a frustrating 10 days. 1 day in the ER, 9 days in the hospital, and it seemed like nobody had a clue what to do with this possible Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Again, I started doing some research on my phone there in the hospital, and the CDC had a protocol that even if you suspect Rocky Mountain spotted fever, start the antibiotic doxycycline.
Right.
And it was like convincing. It was so hard to convince them to start this antibiotic. And in fact, 3 days later, they stopped it without even talking to us about it. And when we brought it up, they said, well, did you see the tick? Did you feel the tick? And of course, at that time, you know, we were in the negative. My wife at the time did not remember being bit or anything like that. Now, my questions for you, Dr. Zorba, is I'd like you to tell me a little bit about the origins or the history, if you're aware of that, how long she should take the antibiotic doxycycline, and also any long-term health effects, and why no medical personnel that I am aware of are doing any studies concerning Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
Yeah, before you answer, Zorba, can we salute our caller's wife for her service to the country?
Yes, yes.
What branch is she in?
She's in the United States Air Force.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Good for her. Okay, let's answer the
question. Well, first of all, Rocky Mountain spotted fever is a rickettsial disease. I mean, it's spread, you know, I'd have to go to the CDC website to look at how much doxycycline and how long, and I don't have a computer in front of me, but I follow the CDC guidelines. A couple of things. Did she develop a rash, by the way?
She did develop a rash, but it was not the full blaring typical Rocky Mountain spotted fever rash.
Did they have an ID doc, infectious disease doc, look at her and help determine? And then what sort of blood test did she? Did she have blood tests that showed that she had Rocky Mountain spotted fever?
All sorts of panels. Mm-hmm. Well, the way it works, according to the CDC, is you want to test immediately, do a tick screen.
Right.
They tell you it's going to come up negative.
Right, and then you do a test later on.
Right. Right. 3 weeks later. 3 weeks later, after we... The hospital refused to believe that it was Rocky Mountain spotted fever. 3 weeks later, we have another test done directed at the hospital on base, the clinic on base. Sure enough, it comes up positive for Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
So if it was negative at one and it's positive again, she definitely had it. So that's the diagnosis. And clearly there was something going on with the hospital. If you're sitting there on your phone and saying, hey, what about Rocky Mountain spotted fever? I'm looking at there. Obviously, they weren't paying attention to you. And why they weren't paying attention to you, I just don't know. They obviously should have been paying attention to you. And sometimes hospitals and doctors suffer from a potentially terminal disease that begins with an A, and we call it arrogance. There are other words that begin with an A, too, that we cannot mention on public radio. I'd have to look at the CDC, but generally the doxycycline, you generally take it for about 2 weeks. The real issue is, are there sequelae that follow this, because there can be joint pain and other things that occur after Rocky Mountain spotted fever. How's she feeling now?
She's feeling better. She doesn't feel absolutely normal.
Mm-hmm. How long ago was this? How many weeks ago was this?
3 months.
Three months ago. Okay. So first of all, number one, 3 months is not a long time. But it takes a while to get over this disease when you have it. And the real issue is to make sure that she had a full course of antibiotics, which is either 10 days or 2 weeks of doxycycline. And if she didn't have it, then I would recommend you call her primary care doctor and say, you know, she only had 5 days or only had 7 days, and she ought to have the complete course to make sure that the antibiotic was on there. Have you written a letter to the hospital? Have you written a letter to the head of the hospital?
Good. Yes. We sure have.
Good.
We spelled it out, and basically we got a letter back saying, thank you for your concern.
Uh-huh. Who did you write the letter to? Thank you for your concern. Happy birthday. Who did you write the letter to? Did you write it to the president of the hospital?
I don't think it was the president.
Oh, no. You should write the president of the hospital, and you should say, look, I am not pleased with the care. Let me tell you the reasons. And then I would write down, and I would say, I think you have some quality control issues. I'd like to come in and talk to you about them. I mean, if they just said, thank you for your concern, that doesn't really ride it. And if you really want to shake their tree, and frankly, it's good for the hospital. Because what happens they have to look and say, we all make mistakes.
Sure.
What did we do wrong with this care? What was wrong with this? How do we improve it? And frankly, that's how we improve medical care, by looking at our mistakes and improving them. So good luck to your wife. She will get better. It'll take 6 to 9 months to get better from Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks for sharing.
Appreciate the call. Thanks a lot. I'm still trying to think of the word you couldn't say on the air.
That's
the same as
that
arrogance.
It begins with A that sounds like arrogance. And it's two syllables. We'll just leave it right along. And arrogance is a three-syllable word.
Let's jump now into our first topic, changing the subject. We received a handwritten letter from a listener in La Crosse, Wisconsin, who had many questions about patients' rights and the high costs of tests and procedures. The listener also noted that they had experienced extreme differences from the doctor to doctor on how many tests are ordered, and they thought doctors were applauded for generating more revenue. Zorba, can we discuss patients' rights and your experience with this?
Well, it's very interesting. In the letter, and if we read the letter, it would take about half the show. It's a long letter, but it was very interesting, because this is somebody who said, you know, I'm retired from 4 decades as an ER flunky. So we know within the letter that he was not a doctor in there. And he was talking about the fact that, here it is, patients come in, physicians then, and it's true, we'll order an EKG, we'll order a CAT scan, we'll order a whole bunch of tests. Don't necessarily tell the patient, hey, this is going to be expensive. The patients may not have any insurance at all. All of a sudden, they're stuck with a bill. It's a big issue. I mean, if I have my insurance, I'm only stuck with my copay. But with present care today, I might have a deductible that's thousands of dollars. And I go to the ER, and all of a sudden, I have $2,000 worth of testing. It said, well, we've found out you don't have a kidney stone. You don't have a brain tumor. You're not having a heart attack. Nothing is wrong with you. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching.
Give us our thousands of dollars, yeah.
Well, our doctors actually reinforced for doing tests. Not that I know of. I don't think that's the case. On the other hand, hospitals don't say, wait a minute, is this test really necessary? What are we going to do for the test? And it is true that doctors are reinforced for doing more testing because then they're less likely to be sued. And using clinical judgment has become a thing of the past in many cases. And it's especially true in the emergency room. Now, I worked in the emergency room many, many years ago before CAT scans were freely available. Well, now you go to the ER, and if you've got a head injury and if there's any question, do a CAT scan. Spend the money. Well, patients require it. A medical malpractice is there. Physicians are there. So it's a complicated problem. But to give this person the ultimate information that I think is necessary, if you're in the emergency room and a test is ordered, you should ask the physician, why are you doing this test? Is this a decision point? Do you think the test is going to give you a lot of information? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they may say, well, my clinical judgment is you don't need the CAT scan for your head. That may cost, I don't know, $500 or $1,000. I have no idea because I'm not told what these tests are about. I work for a large group now. And say, well, I think clinically I don't think you need the test. Well, then you can say, I don't want the test. It's your choice. And I think that interaction should be done because that costs billions and billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah, but let me take the doctor's point of view.
You're going to take the doctor's point of view?
You're the patient. I'm the doctor.
Okay, I got my patient.
I examine you.
Okay.
And
you're
it's
examining
not,
me.
Not,
I'm trying to
it's picture not
that.
Clear to me exactly what's wrong.
Right.
I think it might be A. Uh-huh. It might be B. Mm-hmm. It might be C. Uh-huh. It might be D. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your health above all else. Mm-hmm. I want to have you tested for all of those things.
Well, no. You don't necessarily do A, B, C, or D. You may do A, and let's get the results of A. And if that's negative, then we do B. And if that's negative, then we do C. You don't have to do all the tests at once. You can do the tests sequentially. You might be in the ER longer, but then we'll do less testing because the first test may give us the result. Now, if it's a blood test, you want to be stuck once. And frankly, you're going to do the blood test at one time because that's going to be easier. But you may get it from the blood test or the urine test or the CAT scan or the CT. But do you have to order them all at once? Well, the answer is, yeah, we got to get you out of the emergency room because we need another spot. Yeah. Why? Yeah. Well, we don't have enough primary care doctors to go around. So it's a complicated issue. There's a lot of testing that is done that we shouldn't be doing in this country, and it's costing us, we're talking tens of billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. 800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. On to the phones again, Zorba. Houston, Texas joins us. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. Hi, Tom. How are you guys?
Okay. How can we help?
Well, I had my daughter about 13 months ago, and after I had her, I was exclusively breastfeeding, you know, pumping and doing all that. But at the same point, I was going through some pretty bad postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. And so after about, I would say, 10 weeks, towards the end of my maternity leave, I just decided that I had to go back on my mood stabilizing medication, and that the medication that I have is not approved for breastfeeding women. So I obviously stopped breastfeeding and went back on the medication, and things have been going really well since then. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to get your opinion on what you think in regards to breast is best, and how much do you think that it's correlation, not necessarily causation, when you look at the, I guess, the studies and what the findings have been for that.
Mm-hmm. You know, you bring up such an interesting, this is such a good topic. We know that breastfeeding has advantages, but we know that raising children has, it's a very complex thing. And you have to look at the situations that occur and then look at it. Breastfeeding is one of many components that lead to good childhood health. Now, postpartum depression is an awful thing. It's terrible, and it is common. It is not an uncommon thing. And treating postpartum depression is far more important than breastfeeding your child. Now, there are some people who will disagree with me, but I would say to them, tell me the literature, chapter and verse, to show that you really find that there's that it's important to take one step versus another. And they don't have it because there's no scientific literature out there to show it. But treating your depression so that you can be with your child, nurture your child, and feel good is far more important than breastfeeding your child. And so, you know, my mother didn't breastfeed me. She was an older mom at that time. She was 38 years old. She had a wet nurse for a month because that's what they did in those days. She had no breast milk. And so they had a woman who came in. I don't remember who she was. Mm-hmm. I have a picture of her somewhere. And she breastfed for a month. And then she used formula. I turned out just fine as a person. I mean, I'm okay.
Yeah. I don't remember whether I was breastfed or not.
Yeah, well, but, you know, I turned out all right. There are a lot of formula-fed children that turn out just fine. The answer is be with your child, love your child. Paying attention to mood is far more important. Do not have guilt. Do not have guilt praying to the altar of breastfeeding as the beginning of the end. And that's it. And I've looked at the literature. I mean, the literature with breastfeeding is really much more complex than it seems to be. It's not just breast is best. Because it's breast is best under many circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very important thing to do. You did the right thing, by the way. So you must have gone through some soul searching during that time.
Yes, definitely. And my doctors said the exact same thing, too. But, you know, there's always that guilt there of did I really do what's best for my child? Yeah.
And, well, let me tell you something, because I now have older children. Guilt is always present. When anything goes wrong with your child, you always go, what did I do with that? And it's a funny thing. But children raising children are very, very complex. So give up your guilt, love your child, and have a wonderful time.
Okay, thank you so much.
And thank
Doctor.
You, and really thank you for sharing that, to share that with others.
That's we really appreciate the call. And by the way, Zorba, you have the very best kids in the world.
Oh, you're very kind.
And before the break now, let's fire off another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc.
The following email came to us from a listener in Minnesota named Larry. He writes, I'd like to comment about something you said in a recent show in response to a listener who asked a question about arsenic in apple seeds. You responded that the amount of arsenic is insignificant and that a person could go ahead and chew and eat apple seeds. I have both good news and bad news about this.
Wait, you're giving me the good news first,
The
right?
good news good. Is that you are correct.
Oh, good.
That the
good.
Amount of good. Arsenic is insignificant.
Good.
The bad news is that apple seeds contain cyanide.
Oh, no!
And the amount of cyanide is enough that the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry says that even small amounts of cyanide can be dangerous and people should avoid eating the seeds of apples.
Cyanide!
Perhaps people often confuse cyanide and arsenic. And
really?
Perhaps that's what may have happened in the case discussed on your show.
I can't believe that people actually confuse cyanide and arsenic.
I know you don't.
I mean,
that.
Really. Everyone pays attention to cyanide and arsenic. You know what we have to do? I have to do some research on this, and I'm going to do it on a future show. How many apple seeds do you have to eat in order to get cyanide poisoning? And you know something? We may even have a contest on this on the website, but I'm going to look this up in the future.
Do you know about the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry?
I've never heard of it, but you know something? That doesn't mean much. I'm just going to check with the CDC. I'm going to find out how much cyanide is in it, how much arsenic is in it, and how many apple seeds you have to eat in order to get cyanide poisoning. I do know one thing. You can't buy dried apple seeds in a natural food store, so they must not be good for you, or somebody would have done it.
Do you have a deep-seated disagreement with Zorba? Just post it in our Facebook page or send it in an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More calls coming up, as well as our tasty recipe. And today we have a controversial Facebook feedback segment. All coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. The number is 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But Zorba, before our next call, our recipe.
Yes. Now, Tom, this is a recipe that you will never make, let me assure you. And actually, I don't think you've ever made any of the recipes we've done on this show.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But this is one you are less likely to make because it takes more.
Can we do a TV dinner for our recipe?
Can we do a TV dinner? That's right. I wonder if they still call them TV dinners.
No, they don't.
Do they call
that? No, they
don't. What do they call them?
I don't know.
What are they? Do you have any word? Let's ask our producer. What do we call them?
iPhone dinners.
iPhone dinners. That's right. Let's do an iPhone dinner. I love it.
Okay, so, what is this one?
Zucchini noodles with avocado, pesto, and shrimp. So, do you like zucchini?
No.
Okay. Do you like noodles?
No.
Do you like avocado?
No.
Do you like pesto?
No.
You do like shrimp.
I love shrimp.
I knew I would. Let's do it anyway. Okay, so you're going to start out with five medium zucchinis that you're going to trim. You're going to have to work on this. It's a recipe that takes a bit of work. So this is a recipe for the adventurous cook. Mm-hmm. So five medium zucchinis.
Five medium zucchinis.
You can't be that slothful and lazy
okay.
That you're not going to say it. You're going to use some salt. Okay, one ripe avocado.
A ripe avocado.
A cup of fresh basil leaves.
Cup of fresh basil leaves.
Now, Tom, as you know, an inexpensive place to get fresh basil leaves is in an Asian grocery store because they have them and they're cheaper than larger grocery stores. And you knew that, right?
Well, I recall you've mentioned that before in the show, yes.
Okay. Quarter cup of unsalted shelled pistachios.
Quarter cup unsalted shelled pistachios.
Yeah. Do you ever buy pistachio nuts?
No.
Oh, I love them. Do you remember those red pistachio nuts you'd get?
Oh, yeah, I do.
You know, they were red and they would stain your fingers red. Do you want to know why they were red when you were kids?
Yeah, tell me.
Well, they were red because the covers of the nuts themselves, they didn't look very good and people wouldn't buy them. So somebody got the right idea that they would use the red dye until the red dye was outlawed because it caused cancer. And if you remember, you put them in your hands and your hands would be red and they'd be salty. And I remember licking the salt and the red on them and the dye caused cancer and they put it on to sell the nuts. How ridiculous. This was that. Anyway, these are shelled pistachio nuts. I know I'm getting off message.
That's okay.
2 tablespoonfuls of lemon juice.
2 big tea lemon juice.
Oh, you didn't repeat it. Okay. 1/4 cup of extra virgin olive oil. Plus, you're going to use a little more after that.
1/4 cup extra virgin olive oil.
3 cloves of garlic minced.
3 cloves of garlic minced.
1 pound of raw shrimp. Use the 21 to 25 count. So that's kind of a medium one. They're not the jumbos. And 1 teaspoon of Old Bay seasoning.
A little tea, Old Bay seasoning.
Now, if you don't have Old Bay seasoning in your house, it's really a wonderful seasoning. I really use it. It's a wonderful go-to seasoning that's been around, I bet, for 100 years. Okay, here's the hard part. It's not hard. This is the part that takes work. Using a spiral vegetable slicer or vegetable peeler, cut the zucchini lengthwise into long, thin strands or strips. So basically, you're making them into things that look like noodles. Mm-hmm. Stop when you reach the seeds in the middle because the seeds will make the noodles fall apart. Place the zucchini noodles noodles. These are noodles that you made out of it in a colander. Toss it with a half teaspoon of salt. Let it drain for about 15 to 20 minutes and then gently squeeze out to remove any excess water. It's important to remove the water from the zucchini noodles that you're making because otherwise the whole thing's going to fall apart. So you're basically making zucchini noodles. Meanwhile, combine avocado, basil, pistachios, lemon juice, pepper, and a 1/4 teaspoon of salt in a food processor. Pulse it until finely chopped. Add a 1/4 cup of olive oil and process it until it's smooth. Okay, that's in one side. Now, heat 1 tablespoon of olive oil in a large skillet over medium heat. Add the garlic and cook about 30 seconds to a minute to sort of get the garlic into a fragrance. Add the shrimp, toss it, sprinkle with some Old Bay seasoning, cook it until it's down about 3 to 4 minutes. If you cook it too long, it's going to become gummy. Transfer that to a large bowl. Then add the remaining 1 tablespoon of oil to the pan, and then use your drained zucchini oil. Gently toss it for about 3 minutes. So you're gently cooking it and tossing it. Transfer that to the bowl. Add your pesto, toss it, put the shrimp on top, and you've got a wonderful dish. And it really is a unique dish because it's got zucchini noodles. And once you master it, it's great. Now, the first time you make this, you may have trouble because you're not going to get enough water out of that zucchini. But make sure that zucchini with the salt sits in that colander to get the water out and really press it out. And you're going to have a unique dish for your company that you're going to want to do. This is not a Tom and Monica dish. This is a dish for the adventurous cook, but it really will be a fun dish if you serve this. I highly recommend it.
I'm not going to get tested on putting that all together.
You know, anymore. You have to do the whole thing backwards. That's what you have to do. Now, I know that no one has taken this off and written it down because I've talked about it too quickly, but if you go to our website, zorbapastor.org, you can find this dish, other dishes, and wonderful dishes at zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Back to the phones we go now, Zorba, at 800-462-7413. Here's a listener in Hudson, Wisconsin now. Hi.
Hi, Zorba and Tom. My question is in regards to the increased number of teens that are vaping. And my understanding that it's not really closely regulated. But the teens that I'm speaking with are telling me that there's no negative health effects of the nicotine or the CBD oil in which they're breathing in. And my understanding, of course, is that there's limited testing and science to prove otherwise. So I would like to speak with them and ask them about my concerns about the inhalation of the vegetable glycerin suspension that they're breathing in.
100%. Now, wait, CBD, what is CBD oil?
Well, that's a cannabis derivative oil that apparently they're getting out of the cannabis.
Yeah, so that's, of course, there, you know, anything you inhale. So first of all, let's talk about fresh air. Fresh air means nothing in the air. There's nothing like taking a deep breath and blowing out fresh, non-polluted air. So when you're vaping, you are using polluted air. It's polluted. What is it polluted with? Nicotine. And there was an interesting article in the New York Times. They did an investigative report, found that some of the oils had heavy metals in it, like lead and cadmium and other heavy metals that may indeed be bad for your lungs. Because we know that anything you inhale into your lungs that isn't pure, clean air is not good air, period. End of discussion. Now, if you put in something like CBD oil, which may be legal in one state or another, you know, you're vaping a marijuana derivative, and is it healthful? Well, it's marijuana oil. Is marijuana oil healthful? Well, that's a good question. You know, it's certainly used in certain medical situations. And if you're suffering from medical disease and your physician thinks it may be useful and you make a decision with them, that may be a good idea. The feds will not allow research to be done because in their ultimate stupidity, they put it in the same class as heroin. Smoking pot is not the same as heroin, and it's an old-fashioned, you know, issue that came down from J. Edgar Hoover that is ridiculous. We should have lots of research on marijuana to find out if it's good or bad. But be it as it may, we don't have the research, so it's pollution. So we should tell our young people, this is pollution. You are smoking polluted air. What's your next question? And that's what I would tell them.
Sounds great. So the suspensions could have just about anything in them.
Of course, they don't know. Not regulated at all. They're regulated like a cosmetic. So the FDA regulates it with a very light hand. So the FDA has not taken any of them off the market. They haven't, because they don't test them. Why don't they test them? I have no idea. You know, this has a lot to do with federal bills and what the FDA is allowed and not allowed to do. And there are people in the industry. Let's face it. There's a lot of money in e-cigarettes. It's a booming thing, and there are people in that industry that fight it and do not want to have e-cigarettes regulated. Now, they're regulated lightly. In some places, in some states, you've got to be at a certain age to get them. But it's a light regulation because there's huge money behind it that is fighting against the regulation. And that huge money, in many cases, is now owned by the tobacco interests. And we know that the tobacco lobby is a rather strong lobby. And that's my feeling. Now, e-cigarettes may have a place. I want to go to the other side of it for a minute. For people who smoke cigarettes, I've been very much against e-cigarettes because I think they ought to be regulated. There now is decent data that people who smoke cigarettes, and cigarettes are far worse than e-cigarettes, can get off their cigarettes by going to e-cigarettes. And e-cigarettes, I do believe, based on today's data, are safer than smoking tobacco. But I still do not believe that e-cigarettes are safe as... good, clean, fresh air. Thank you.
Sounds good. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure. Appreciate the call. Thank you for calling. And before the break, Zorba, we love it when our listeners get social on our Facebook page. Time again for Facebook Feedback.
Facebook Feedback.
Okay, Zorba, you recently posted an article on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Facebook page called Take a Closer Look at That Cocktail Mug.
Yes.
First, tell us what that article was about.
It was about the Moscow Mule.
That's a drink?
That's a drink. Moscow Mule is made with vodka, lime juice, and ginger beer. And wrote an article about it. Specifically, I wrote about copper poisoning that might leach out into your Moscow Mule because of the lime juice. And lime juice has a low pH that can then leach out the copper. If you have a mug that is not aluminum on the inside, it is copper on the inside. That's right. I wrote about that. That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
It generated some chatter on Facebook. From our listeners.
I got a lot of cheddar out of Moscow, too. They even let me out of Moscow.
Here's a sample. First, Mo in Illinois wrote, I would not drink out of one. Marlene in Minneapolis, Minnesota echoes that with, a copper mug? No, no, no. However, Tim questions, but water in your house comes from a copper line.
That's right.
Steve adds, many less alarmist groups have pointed out, unless you're an alcoholic, you're probably not going to get copper poisoning from a copper mug Moscow Mule.
Well, to answer the water issue, the water is safe in a copper pipe because it has a pH of 7.0. It's the low pH that actually leaches it out. So it's actually the lime juice. But Moscow Mules, although they're served in a copper mug, most of the time the copper mug is not copper on the inside. It's on the outside. And the reason that I even got into this whole thing is I thought it looked rather hip to stand around with a copper mug drinking a Moscow Mule. And I don't drink a lot, but if I drink a martini out of a martini glass, I tend to shake it, and I'm afraid the martini is going to come out. So I could look really hip at a bar drinking out of a Moscow Mule, and that started this whole ball rolling.
Here's more. Jane in Massachusetts shared this. Since living in the Middle East in a country with lots of people from the subcontinent, I became interested in many of the new customs. One was to drink water from a copper pitcher or cup. Ayurvedic teachings say the water from a copper pitcher is very healthy. Now I'm not sure what to think.
Well, actually, but water is a pH of 7.0, so copper does not leach out. So it's absolutely safe to drink water out of a copper cup. It's also safe to do things like, you know, whipped cream. Whipped cream, we have a bowl that I used to make whipped cream out of, and that was copper on the inside. It's the pH is the issue. pH, folks. pH. Acid pH.
Had enough?
Give me more.
Here comes.
Give me more. Go ahead.
Terry in Utah says, cheers, Zorba. Moscow mules next time you're in Logan.
Okay, got it.
Let's keep the Facebook love coming, and you can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More calls to come, as well as another interesting topic and our medical Mythbuster segment, all coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413, our number if you have a question for Zorba. But Zorba, before our next call, FDA approval of a new vaccine for shingles.
Shingles. So you had chickenpox. Do you remember chickenpox at all?
I don't think I had chickenpox.
Oh, no. I bet you had chickenpox. I bet you had. If not, you ought to be tested or you ought to get the – we'll talk about the shingles vaccine. I mean, I had chickenpox. I remember my mother thought I'd go blind, so she put me in a room.
I had measles. I never had chickenpox.
Yeah, I bet you had. 98% of the kids had chickenpox, so you may have been too young to remember. But anyway,
Yeah, all right.
If you've had chickenpox, you are at risk for shingles. And about roughly 30% of the people who have chickenpox get shingles because the chickenpox virus, varicella, is in the ganglion, lives in the ganglion, a nerve cell, just stays there. And when immunity goes down, it pops out.
Well, that's why I've never gotten shingles, because I never got chickenpox.
Well, the shingles vaccine is a pretty good thing to do. But the problem is the shingles vaccine, Merck made the first shingles vaccine, introduced about 2 decades ago. It's about 50% effective, roughly. It all depends on your age. If you're younger when you get the vaccine, we'll say when you're 60, it's more effective than when you're 70. Already with the immune response. But there is a new shingles vaccine, which is a two-part vaccine. You don't get just one shot, you get two shots. And it's much, much more effective. It's in the 90% effective range, which is really much, much better.
That's a big improvement.
It's a big improvement. And both shingles shots, even if you end up getting shingles with the Merck vaccine, you're still less likely to have post-herpetic neuralgia, which is this pain that can be just awful, that can last for years. So the vaccine cuts down on post-herpetic neuralgia. The new vaccine cuts down on post-herpetic neuralgia by maybe up to 90%. The old vaccine, about 65%. So this new vaccine is really dynamite. It's very, very important. Now, the question is, if people who have the old vaccine, should they get the new vaccine? I don't have an answer to that. But if you have never had the shingles vaccine, you should get it when it's available. And I recommend that you only get the new vaccine, which is a two-part vaccine. I would recommend not getting the Merck vaccine, which is a one shot, but you get the two shot when it's available because it's far more effective.
Yeah, I know my wife had shingles. Very painful.
It's very. Now, does she have post-herpetic neuralgia? Does she still have pain or discomfort in the area?
Nope.
So it can be very, very painful. And there are treatments for that. But it reminds me, again, about adult immunization. We now have two pneumonia shots, not one. Does not prevent all pneumonias, but it prevents many pneumonias. We now have the shingles vaccine. It's important for every older adult to get the influenza vaccine because influenza kills 10,000 to 20,000 people a year. And it's important to get the DTaP, which protects against pertussis and diphtheria and tetanus. Get your shots, adults. Go to your doctor.
800-462-7413, our number, 800-462-7413. As we get back to the phones now, Zorba, welcoming a listener in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I live in the desert Southwest, obviously, and we get a great deal of direct sun, very hot direct sun.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a strange reaction when the sun hits my head. I get first a tingling and a tightness, usually in the back of the head, sometimes the top of the head. Once that happens, I get a headache.
Well, these are migraine headaches. That's what you're getting. And they're just sun-induced. It's photophobia. It's induced by the sun. Then you don't like the light. And it's the brightness of the sun, and it's triggering off a migraine headache. That's what you're getting. They're migraines. What do you take for them when you get them?
I've gone on chelated magnesium, and that has really made a difference.
What is chelated magnesium? I know what magnesium is. What do you pay for it? Where do you get it, and what is it?
Well, I get it at a vitamin, it's called Vitamin Shop, mm-hmm. and I get it here, and I really don't know why it's different than usual magnesium, but mm-hmm. I know it is kind of hard to find.
Okay, so it gives you magnesium. Magnesium is a good thing to give. Does it work for you?
It has worked a great deal for
Super.
All of the other mm-hmm. migraines that I was getting, which had become very extreme.
Sure.
But really the only time these headaches set in now is this sun issue.
Mm-hmm. You live in a place that's sunny.
Yes, sir. I do.
It's pretty bright out there in El Paso. It's certainly brighter than it is in Seattle, Washington.
Here's a solution.
You're right.
Move to Wisconsin.
Yes, move to Wisconsin. No.
Believe me,
Seattle.
I would if I could. I would move in a moment's notice.
Move to Seattle. Have you been on a beta blocker before?
No, sir. I don't think so.
I'd recommend a beta blocker. Talk to your neurologist. Low-dose beta blocker, propranolol. Name brand used to be Inderol, propranolol, atenolol. Beta blockers work really well for migraines. They prevent a lot of migraines in people. Sometimes just a tiny dose of a beta blocker can make a big difference and just either take the edge off of the migraine so it doesn't bother you that much or stop it completely. If it happens on a regular basis, and as you said, you are in a sunny climate where it is really a bright sun, and I've been to El Paso, and the sun there is much, I have to tell you, it's much brighter than it is in Wisconsin, at least. It seems brighter to me, maybe because it's also so hot. I would definitely go to a beta blocker and see if that would work, and if not, I would try one of the other ones, because, you know, you're not going to get rid of the sun, and like you say, as soon as it hits your head, it sets it off. So, beta blocker, that's my recommendation.
Okay. Very good. Thank you so much.
And keep up the chelated magnesium. I know magnesium has been used in headaches for people for many, many years, but I'm not familiar with that form. But if it works, keep it up.
I will do that.
Thank you. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. 800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, time again now for our medical MythBuster. Today's question comes from a listener in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, named Marlin. Dear Dr. Zorba, many people in our family suffered gas pain and smelly flatulence and bloating in recent years. Every one of them found that cutting out dairy products such as regular milk completely eliminated their problem. It seems that all of them suddenly acquired lactose intolerance. Our theory is that there is some new chemical or drug used in the dairy industry that has triggered this condition for those of us who have been drinking milk all of our lives. So, I can tell what is coming. What do you think, Zorba? Is this a myth or is there truth to this theory?
So in other words, the dairy industry would be putting a chemical in milk to make sure that you can't drink milk later on. We're calling shooting yourself in the foot. I think I'll just shoot myself in the foot. Put something in there so they can't drink my product anymore. And then my product won't be used and I'll die. This is like the shakers. You know, the shakers were against having sex, so they died off because they didn't procreate. That's what happened. They thought sex was a sin, so you don't see shakers anymore. I don't know if you knew that.
How come there are fewer of us here than
shakers?
There used
That's
to be.
Right. We don't know why. We don't believe in sex, and we're not having, there are no children around anymore. But anyway, getting off the sex topic and back into milk, although milk is a sexy topic in Wisconsin, no, you can get lactose intolerance as as you get older. And you can't drink milk. You just have to use lactate, which is an enzyme in there, if you want to continue to use it. And people do develop milk intolerance. It's a genetic issue. Tends to run in families like it did in that family. But it's not a communist plot to get rid of. Communist plots aren't around anymore. They might be in fake news, but they're not in the dairy industry.
There's at least a little movement started now to get rid of America's Dairyland on our license plates.
Really? There's a movement? Why do we want to get rid of America's Dairyland?
Well, some people, don't want to be identified with milk.
America. got it. So we want to make it like a vegan wonderland. That's what we want to do. Vegan from America's Dairyland to the vegan wonderland.
Have a potential myth for Zorba. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. Keep them coming, folks. I love them.
Let's get back to the phones now at 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, a listener with us in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. How can we help?
I wake up every morning and my hands are swollen and they ache in the joints. I've had chondrocarditis and inflammation in the bursas in my hips, and my feet are swollen all the time, too. And I take ibuprofen sometimes. I'll take the naproxen, but I can't take that stuff all the time. And I'm trying to figure out what in my diet or lifestyle changes can I make to reduce this inflammation.
It must really bother you to have this all the time. It must really interfere with your life.
How
long has it been going on for?
It's been going on for about a year and a half now that it's been really bothering me.
Okay, change in lifestyle? Any change, job change, anything else going on, stressors in your life?
Well, I'm working, which is actually not a stressor. I love my job.
Uh-huh. What kind of job do you have?
I work for Habitat for Humanity.
Cool.
So I love it.
Cool, cool. Yeah, it certainly is wonderful. Okay, so you've got a job that you like. Physical stresses, recent illnesses, anything that might be going on?
No, not recent illnesses. I do have fibromyalgia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's really about it.
When you say inflammation, you mean you're really talking about pain? I mean, is that really, are those really the symptoms that you have?
Pain and swelling.
Uh-huh, and swelling, okay. Because fibromyalgia itself can produce lots of pain. We don't just have trigger points, but you can get pain in all over in your soft tissues when you have fibromyalgia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that could be enough to explain the chronic pain that you have. It wouldn't explain the swelling, but it certainly could explain chronic pain. What do you do for exercise? Are you able to do any exercise at all?
Yeah, I walk my dog, and I just recently started weightlifting.
Uh-huh. One of the things that exercise I want to get to is the type of exercise. Well, I've got some suggestions. These really are suggestions that I think have a lot to do with chronic pain. One aspect with chronic pain is exercise. You've got to find an exercise plan that works for you. One of the best exercises for chronic pain are water exercises because you're eliminating a lot of the issues with gravity. You're moving the joints in a warm water pool, and you may want to look into that. That can do marvelous things.
She lifts weights. That's not good.
Well, weights might be okay, but they might not be. Weights are not the first thing you think about with chronic pain. The first thing you think about is what can I do to soften up my ligaments, stretch the ligaments, the tendons, the muscles, and the nerves. And weightlifting does not do that. Weightlifting might be part of a good program, but really what you want are range of motion activities. So I would recommend, number one, looking at some kind of water aerobics and giving it like a trial. You may be able to join a health club which has a warm water pool for 3 months, see what it does. I would not sign a 2-year contract, which they always want you to sign, but I would look at something like that. That's the first step. You're right about not using anti-inflammatories all the time. You only want to take them for a limited amount of time. You certainly don't want to be around them all the time. I think this is related to your fibromyalgia. I'm not convinced that this is inflammation because with fibromyalgia, there's no evidence of inflammation. We just know there's evidence of pain. We know there's pain, there's discomfort. We know that it's real. But if we look at the muscles and the ligaments under the microscope, we don't see inflammation. It feels like inflammation, but it's not necessarily inflamed. You need warm water aerobics and more sleep.
Okay. Those are definitely lifestyle changes.
They are. They are. And that's the way you treat this. So thanks much. And keep up the good work with Habitat for Humanity. That's really a kudos to you for doing that.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Take care.
We appreciate that call at 800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Before we head out today, Zorba, let's tackle a listener question. This one came to us from John in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, who took the time to handwrite and mail us a letter. He wrote, "Sir, what is your opinion on the prostate-specific antigen test, the PSA test? Is this test very accurate, and does old age affect the result? Also, what is the government's conclusion on this test?"
The government has concluded that we shouldn't be doing the PSA test on a regular basis. And the reason is a whole bunch of reasons. Doesn't pick up 40% of the prostate cancers. Mm-hmm. It's called a false negative. And 40% of the time or not, there is no prostate cancer at all. So it's got a lot of false positives, lots of false negatives. The U.S. Public Service Task Force, a very conservative screening agency made up of really, really good people, has given the PSA test a flunking grade. That the risk is that there's risk involved that is worse than the benefit. It hasn't been neutral on it. It said it's a bad test. And so I have stopped using the PSA test. I don't use it in men. If they want to have it, I can get it, you know, I can actually do it. And the reason is the long-term results have been miserable. Now, where is the misery? The misery has come not in the fact that we aren't picking up some prostate cancer. It is true. But when you look at the long-term studies and the crude death rate, even though you are less likely to die of prostate cancer because we might pick it up and give you surgery, the death rate either from the surgery, complications from the surgery, or heart attacks and strokes 15 years out is the same. So in other words, you may not die of prostate cancer, but you may die of something else. So I have now moved against the PSA test unless there is a reason to do it, such as blood in the urine and other problems. So that's my long and short answer. I've always said it is the most controversial test in medicine, and I always get letters after this, pro and anti-PSA.
I have a question for Zorba. Feel free to write us, tweet us, or post it to our Facebook page, or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast,
visit us at ZorbaPastor.org or through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1104Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.